The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I thought we might begin by having just a brief quote from a few years ago, but from the man who has recently become President of the United States.
Get even. When somebody screws you, screw them back and stay.
Feel nice and calm to know that that's the man in charge of the United States military, doesn't it? But it seems to have worked for Mr. Trump. He's now in the top job, I guess you could argue. Now, in your handout is an A5 insert with 8 statements about life. Let me read them and see if you think that this is... How does this resonate with the way that the world works? Happy are the successful, for they control their own lives. Happy are those with calloused consciences, for they're enjoying life. Happy are the assertive, for they get what they want. Happy are the morally indifferent, for they live how they wish. Happy are those who take revenge, for they always get even. Happy are those who are comfortable with their own foibles, for they won't worry about God. Happy are the agitators, for they will be noticed. Happy are those who don't believe in anything too much, for they will have a nice, easy life. It does seem that often that's the way that the world works. It's certainly what sells books. I've just got a few random covers there of books that have sold very well. It seems like how to have the good life, and that is to be assertive, to be aggressive, to push, to get your own way. Now, there's one very famous man who's just said, if someone screws you, screw them back in spades. This morning we look at the teaching of another man who says something very, very different and has changed the world. As we've been working our way through Matthew's Gospel, we now come to chapter 5, and we get to perhaps the most famous speech ever given, the Sermon on the Mount. Strangely, the Sermon on the Mount is only, you can read it out loud slowly in about 12 minutes. Matthew chapters 5, 6 and 7. If anyone says they're comfortable with the Sermon on the Mount, they've never read it. If anyone ever says that, just call after, have you ever read it? It is the most uncomfortable, challenging document I think you could ever read. Jesus is talking about what does it mean, or what would it look like to live in the kingdom of heaven? To have God as your king, or Jesus as your king, to live in relationship with God. Matthew will talk about the kingdom of heaven because Matthew is written, certainly a large part of Matthew's audience was Jewish and they didn't say the name of God. So Matthew will talk about the kingdom of heaven, and Luke and Mark quote Jesus speaking about the kingdom of God. It's just a slight change. I thought we might begin at least, this is the last week for a while on Matthew's Gospel, but let's at least begin by reading these first few verses where Jesus begins. To put it in context, at the end of chapter 4, Jesus has stirred up people from all over the country. They've travelled, Matthew says, from north, south, east and west. Thousands have come to him, probably initially because he could heal and people would bring the sick to him to be healed, and then they were amazed at how he taught. So if you you can ignore the B attitudes, as I've called them, the first lot, and have a look at the Sermon on the Mount, or the beginning of it is on the inside of your program. So chapter 5, verse 1. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him and he began to teach them. The way that Matthew's structured his gospel very carefully, The scene is that his disciples, or those who would follow him, are sitting at the front and listening. we don't know how many, because the 12 disciples or the 12 apostles aren't mentioned by name until chapter 10. You've got disciples or followers at the front, and then at the back is the crowd listening. We're told in Matthew chapter, right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. So I guess if you read the Sermon on the Mount, if you've already decided that you want to be a follower of Jesus, you can sit at the front and listen. If you're not sure where you stand, or you just want to rub your chin and have a think, you can be one of the crowd at the back. Either way, it works. What I want to do today is to motivate you to read the Sermon on the Mount again. What have I done? The initial thing that I had, I called the B attitudes about how to be successful and aggressive and assertive, etc. All I've done, quite obvious really, is just reverse Jesus' teaching about what it means to be blessed. I've just reversed the Beatitudes. Why does it seem like the way our world so often works? Because Jesus reverses the way our world works. All I've done is turn it back again. So let's have a look. By the way, the word beatitude, where does it come from? The Latin word for being blessed is beatus. And so it's just, you know, this is the way to be blessed, or the blessed life. There are eight different sayings there, or eight different statements. It's not eight different kinds of disciples. It's more eight different angles or eight different aspects of character and behaviour. It's like one of those identikit photos. You put together all the different slices and you get the face of the disciple. So let me read it and you see how just get the vibe, the feel of it. So he goes up onto the mountain. He began to teach them. He said, verse 3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Now, if I could say, on first reading, it doesn't really look like the good life, does it? It looks like if you live this way, you're going to get walked on fairly regularly. And my guess is, especially if you work in the law, that you see that that would happen. It doesn't really look like happy hedonism. Now, forgive me for being less than philosophically, you know, exactly accurate, but I'd put it to you that the default position for most Australian people is that they live as hedonists. They may not have thought it through that way, but they live as hedonists. Now, a general definition of hedonism: the ethical theory that pleasure, in the sense of satisfaction of desires, is the highest good and aim of human life. Okay, I'll read it again. The ethical theory that pleasure, in the sense of the satisfaction of desires, is the highest good and proper aim of human life. Now, I've deliberately chosen that kind of sort of more generalised definition of hedonism. I know generally when the term is used, it's the idea of letting your appetites control things and kind of hard living. For example, George Best, the English soccer player, is reputed to have said, "I spent a lot of money on booze, birds and fast cars, and the rest I just squandered." So that, I liked it anyway. This one is saying, no, there can be a wider, more ethical idea or more thoughtful idea of hedonism, and that is, if I'm hitting the grog hard every night or living and eating like a total glutton, in the long run, it's not going to satisfy my desires and it's no good for me. Now, it seems at first glance that Jesus is saying the exact opposite of that. You know, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It doesn't sound like a great day out. And yet, let's look a little closer, and I think you see that. Well, let's see what we see about Jesus and the satisfaction of our desires. You look again at how this is structured. This is beautifully put together. Verses 3 and 10, the first and the last of those blessed statements, are essentially bookends. You notice for each of them it says, "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Verse 3, verse 10, "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And it breaks up into two lots of four, The first four being the inner character of the disciple, or perhaps their attitude before God. So the poor in spirit, those who mourn, those who meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. The second lot is that character should then show itself into the way you act or the way you behave with others. So to be merciful, pure in heart, a peacemaker, that you will be persecuted by others. Now, what's Jesus saying as you put that all together? By the way, verses 11 and 12, I think, are just a further explanation on the last of the Beatitude statements. Okay, so I think you've got eight with the bookends at verse 3 and verse 10. Everything Jesus says here is absolutely loaded with Old Testament allusion and kind of draws from the Old Testament, as with so much of what Jesus teaches. I could just show you a couple, I think. And I think the first one, it's a little hard to work out, is there a deliberate progression in the eight? I'm not sure about that, but I'm sure the first one is first for a reason. Did I say that right? Yeah, the first one is first for a reason. Let's have a look. See verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In the Old Testament, there's a kind of an evolution or progression in this idea of being poor. To be economically poor meant that you would be dependent on someone. It meant usually that you were humble, that you had to rely on someone. You realised you couldn't survive. That took on a kind of a spiritual aspect, that the idea of being or realising your spiritual poverty before God. And so, as Matthew records Jesus' words, is blessed are the poor in spirit, those who acknowledge their spiritual poverty before God. Now, there's a promise in the Old Testament that when God sent the servant, the one who would preach, the one who would set people free, what would he do? Here's a quote from Isaiah, a prophet about 800, 8th century BC. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me, what? To proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners. Now, he's talking about that predominantly as a spiritual thing, to set people free from the consequences of sin and to proclaim good news to those who realise their spiritual poverty and so have ears that are open. I guess if I wanted to say the reason that this is first is it's the exact opposite of pride before God. I know a man the other day who, when heard the Christian message about the need for forgiveness, his reaction was, well, I'm a good person. And I could say, with all the humility I can muster, which is quite a lot, I could say that's the exact opposite of what Jesus wants here. He wants us to acknowledge our spiritual poverty before God. Or to look at the second one, for example, verse 4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Now, I don't know if you noticed, the very next verse in Isaiah talks about to comfort those who mourn. So the one who comes will proclaim the year of the Lord's favour, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn. My wife Kathy took her mum yesterday, sadly, to the funeral of her mum's best friend. She was a lady in her 90s, had 25 grandchildren. As a funeral, it was as good as it gets, but still, there's a great mourning there. Many people read this to say, if you are at a funeral, if you're mourning, then God will comfort you. That's true, but I don't think that's what Jesus firstly had in mind. The idea of mourning in the prophets is very often the idea of mourning or sadness over, well, the Bible's word, sin, over the wrong that we do before God, the wrong that we do to one another, a sadness about that we don't live the lives that we should, we don't measure up. And there's also an element of mourning over the way that our nation or our tribe or our group relate to each other and relate to God. And the promise is, again and again, that God will come and comfort or deal with that problem. There's a great little story in Luke chapter 2. Jesus, as a baby, 8 days old, is taken to the temple in Jerusalem. So Mary and Joseph take him. Bethlehem to Jerusalem's only 2 or 3 hours walk. They take him to the temple to be circumcised, 8 days old, as the law said. And there's an old man who lives in the temple or around the temple called Simeon. And Luke tells us, now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation. I'm not sure why they go for that word. The consolation, the word is exactly the same as the comforting of Israel. And the Holy Spirit was on him. And he sees the baby Jesus. Somehow he knows. He holds the baby knowing that this is the one who will come and comfort those who mourn over sin. The one who will come and deal with the problem. Third one, very quickly. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. The word meek sounds like weak, but it means actually the opposite. Interesting, Jesus uses this exact word of himself in chapter 11, which says, come to me, I am, his word, or the translation then, gentle. And gentleness is strength used carefully to care for someone. You can be very strong and pick up a baby very gently. And Jesus is saying the reason that his followers can afford to be meek or gentle is because God's in control and you will still inherit. Possibly the earth, possibly the land. But the idea is you will get your inheritance. You can still be gentle. Those first four, the hunger and thirst for righteousness, I can't go through them all, but you see, those four character statements will then show themselves in the way that you treat others, or the way that we treat others, in terms of when you understand our own spiritual bankruptcy before God, we'll be ready to forgive others, as per verse 7, to try and work hard to be pure in heart, to make peace, etc. The irony, perhaps, of the last one, verse 10, and then verses 11 and 12 is this. You live that way, if you be poor in spirit, you mourn, you be merciful, you be gentle, you all those things, people will still persecute you. Now, he doesn't say go looking for it. It'll come to you, but you will still suffer if you follow Jesus. Now, different times, different places, very different results, but you will still suffer. Verses 13 and 14 are really about, I think 13, the salt thing, there's quite a lot of ink being spilt about that. What does it mean? You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how will it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. Probably the most straightforward meaning is the idea of salt being a preservative, something that holds things together, stops corruption. I'm not completely sure. The interesting thing is in the Old Testament, the idea of salt was linked to the covenant, to the promises between God and his people. It seems to me more that it lasts, that it's permanent, or that it is different. Salt, Mrs. Miller and Year 8 Science is a long time ago for me, but NaCl is a stable compound and can't kind of stop being salty. But salt can be diluted. And so I think Jesus is saying if the disciple gets diluted and diluted and diluted, the disciple that's not truly a disciple is like salt that's not salty and it's useless. It'll be thrown out. But when behavior is right, the disciple will be like light, light on a hill. See verse 14. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. When Jesus' people live this way before God and then treat others that way, it shines. And people will see that praise will be given to God. So whoever said thank God for the salvos, whatever advertising lunch that was after, they got it right. Now, sadly, you see just how much it works in the complete opposite. And if you're a follower of Jesus, doesn't it break your heart what's happened with the Royal Commission into Child Abuse and so many Christian organisations and what's happened and the way that that affects the reputation of Jesus and his followers? And you see how clearly it works in reverse as well. So to finish up, it's a very big challenge. Jesus calls his people to be like this, to have this as character, this in the way we treat people. My guess is it's hard for everybody, but it's especially hard for some of us. If you're a fairly strong character, if you're articulate, if you can be aggressive, if you can get your own way, isn't it a great temptation to do it? Now, I know that won't be a problem with a room full of lawyers. That'll never be an issue. But it takes great trust in God to decide that you will try and live this way, to be this kind of person, and trust that he will still look after you, that it will still be okay. Now, remember I spoke about hedonism and the satisfaction of desires. It's not wrong to have desires for things. At the risk of reductionism, I think what drives us is the desire to feel significant. And you can call that love or status or respect, self-worth. We want to feel like we matter. And that drives so much of our behaviour. And then the other one is we want to feel secure. We want to feel like we're in control. We want to feel like it'll be okay. Those desires are not wrong. What Jesus says again and again is the way that we look to meet them is wrong. That the behaviour that we have to try and meet those desires either doesn't work, or in the long term lets us down, or damages ourselves, or damages others. And what Jesus wants is that in the long term, the deep desires of our hearts will be met. And if you look at the rewards that he promises, you see how the rewards flow out of the behaviour of the disciple. That is, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They will be comforted. They will inherit the earth. They will be filled. They will be shown mercy. They will see God. They will be called children of God. The great reward for seeking this is that you'll actually become like Jesus. So how do we finish? If you're not yet a follower of Jesus, there's the great challenge to ask that God may open your heart that you want to be like this. If you are, all I've done is skate over the surface today. I think if you're a follower of Jesus, it'd be well worth taking a day for each, or a time for each of those eight statements, and to think through and pray and ask that God may change us to be like that. What does it mean to inherit the earth? At face value, it seems an ungodly objective. The other possibility is you may not want it the way it's going. The word in the Greek is gea, which can mean, it's got the same kind of semantic range as our English. You know, earth can mean, you know, a bucket of dirt, or it can mean the planet, or etc. I think, see, the big thing about the inheritance in the Old Testament, the Old Testament was you would inherit the promised land, or you're part of the promised land. And that's a metaphor or a picture, ultimately, of heaven, the spiritual reality that comes. So I think what Jesus is saying is you can be meek or gentle, and that's meaning not aggressive, not assertive, not pushing. You can be meek or gentle, and you will still inherit. I think at the moment, for the follower of Jesus, you're actually looking to the new creation, is what he's saying. But I guess what he's saying is you won't miss out on your inheritance. That's what he's saying. So do you translate it as earth or land? It's kind of a judgment call. Are we, I'm assuming means if you're a follower of Jesus, are we meant to be agitators for Christianity? As Isaiah and Jesus, the disciples, were also agitators in their way. I guess... yes and no. Jesus and John the Baptist are certainly agitators and deliberately provocative in how they speak. So I would gather that there's a sense in which the Christian message will always stir things up, will always be divisive. Jesus said, you know, he's come to divide people, not deliberately, but that people will react so strongly one way or another to his message. So there may be a place, I'd put it, there's a place for public agitation about listen to Jesus, that sort of thing, but at a personal level, and the Beatitudes, they've probably got a little more airtime than I expected in the questions, the Beatitudes, I was thinking about personal relationships. And the big thing there is, in 1 Peter chapter 3:15, Peter says, always be prepared to give an answer for the faith that you have, but do it with gentleness and respect. Now, that's a great challenge for me, to do it with gentleness and respect. The aim is always to win the person rather than simply win the argument. So I'd say that. There's a time for agitation, but in personal relationships, gentleness and respect. I have heard it taught that the eight Beatitudes broadly follow the process of Christian conversion or life. Do you agree? I'm not sure. I can see certainly that the first one is there, because until you have some kind of humility or aware of your spiritual poverty before God, your ears are not open. You're not going to look to find the kingdom. After that, I'm not sure. I can't particularly see it. I can't see why. I'll go for a maybe, but I'm not really convinced. Did Jesus say, blessed are the poor in spirit, as per Matthew, or blessed are the poor, as per Luke, or both? Yes, in Luke's Gospel, Luke just records, blessed are the poor. Two things to say. One is, we have to allow for the Gospel writers to have slight variation in how they record the teachings of Jesus. Jesus, as an itinerant, is travelling, and he would have been saying the same things again and again. There's some slight variation in the teachings between Luke and Matthew. In Luke chapter 6, you've got the Sermon on the Plain, which is Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount, and yet there are differences in how they've edited it and put it together. Luke is particularly concerned for the poor, the marginalised, the sick, beggars, those who struggle, for Gentiles, and if I could say, he even has a soft spot for women. Which, that was meant to be a joke, all right? Okay. So when he said, he'll pick it up and go for the poor and push that, but I think you need to read it in the context that Matthew actually puts in spirit, to show it's not only the economically poor. But Luke's agenda is to, if I could say, to trouble the rich. Luke, more than any other gospel, deals with the seduction and the problem that money brings to the rich. And so that's why I think he pushes down that line. How is Christ's teaching realistic if evangelical Christian votes caused the election of Donald Trump, a man who has stated he does not need to ask for forgiveness? Probably out of time. Is that fools rush in where... Okay, here's... the following statement is not representative of City Bible Forum and is a personal statement by the speaker. I mean, how's that, boss? Is that all right? Okay. I suspect that many, many, many millions of those who were Christian and voted for Donald Trump in the USA, they know he's not a Christian. There's so many things about him and what he said. Now, not for me to judge, but you can only judge... Sorry, you can... Every indication is that way. I think there were other reasons, and for some of them, I suspect that they were voting for not Hillary. For example, on the issues of abortion, appointment to the Supreme Court, that kind of thing. And so you may well, as I said, hold your nose and vote for a candidate rather than particularly to choose Donald Trump, because I don't think anyone thinks Donald Trump is a Christian, or very few. What will happen as a result? Who knows? There's the old Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. Salt is corrosive, especially to metal. True. That's an interesting idea. I had not thought of that. That's just a comment. With Donald Trump as US president, should we be mourning for America? I reckon there's a fair bit of work to do here before we start looking across the Pacific. So if you want to mourn, that's good. But I reckon if there's any country that's been blessed by God, it's ours. And if there's any country that if I could say humbly, if there's any country that turns their back on God, it's ours. And if there's any country that's very busily forgetting, why we have all the wealth and privileges and the great life that we have here. We're forgetting our heritage and foundations. We have the attention span of a goldfish. So morning is good, but I'd start here. It's also worth focusing on the fact that God's given the solution as well to anyone who'll open their eyes. Is the opposite of blessed being cursed? If you change your opposite beatitudes and by swapping happy with cursed, would that make sense? Interesting idea.
Matthew 23.
The seven woes. Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, in Matthew 23, Jesus gets stuck into the religious leaders about their actions, and yes, use the word woe, which is pretty much the opposite of blessed. Like, you're really going to cop it. Interesting idea. If I could say that the Beatitudes, they do work at one level, but it's short-term thinking. If you play the long game, Jesus is saying his way of living will have significantly different consequences in the long run compared to the other, the reversal of that. But I hadn't thought of that. Matthew 23 is Jesus giving the flip side of that. Sorry, Lindsay? Okay. Yes, I can't think of any direct kind of or reversal of blessed and cursed. But Matthew 23, when Jesus says woe to you, he means whoa, you are in deep trouble. Turn around. Yeah.
Well, that completes, the 5 weeks that Al has been with us. So please, let's thank him.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.